podcasts.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. The Profile is the show where we delve into a person's life, faith and ministry, and it's brought to you in association with the UK's leading Christian magazine, Premier Christianity. If you would like a free sample copy of our latest issue, head to our website, premierchristianity.com/free sample. Simply type your details in and we'd be delighted to send you a free copy of the new edition. But today on the show, I'm delighted to say I'm speaking to Martin Smith. Martin is the former frontman of Delirious, one of the biggest Christian bands of all time. The band were active from 1992 until 2009. And during that time, Martin wrote classic worship songs, including Did You Feel the Mountains Tremble, I Could Sing of Your Love Forever, Majesty, and many more. Now a solo artist, Martin's latest album is Love Song for a City, live worship from across the globe. Martin, welcome to the programme.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to be able to sit down and chat. There's so much I really want to delve into. Let's start with the new album, though. Congratulations on this coming out. This is Love Song for a City.
Thank you.
This has been a long time coming for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's probably been about a couple of years coming. And, you know, it's really an amalgamation of 2 or 3 years of touring, going to different cities across the world with my band. And we started to record everything we were doing. So we would take a mobile setup on the road, maybe get a song everywhere we went, and then we'd take the best of all the moments and then we pieced it together to give you the record that you can listen to now, Love Song for a City.
As you listen back to it, I wonder, does it remind you of some of the places you've been? It's something like 20 different nations, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, cities like Sao Paulo, amazing. You know, you've got Brussels in there. You've got amazing, you know, like Sydney's in there. Cape Town, Joburg. I can't remember. But it's just a little snapshot of what's going on in the world. Yeah. and great to be able to present that in a whole record.
And do you pick up on some of the kind of distinctives on different expressions of Christianity around the world? Are there things to say there? You know, is a worship night in Sao Paulo very different or very similar to Sydney, for example?
Yeah, people ask me that a lot. You know, is it different where you go? And it definitely is. For example, if you go to Colombia, the minute you walk on stage, people are absolutely passionate, desperate to worship God. Maybe certain places in the UK or America, you know, it takes time to warm people up, you know. So generally, and this is not an economic comment, but generally where there's less wealth in a city, that's where people are more passionate. And it's quite sad in a way, but you know, you go to India or Africa and people just, you know, you light the match and it just explodes.
I guess what some people may not know about you, but is very clear if you listen not only to this record, but some other Delirious back catalogue, is you can speak or at least sing in Spanish. There's a couple of instances of Spanish, isn't there?
Can I just set the record straight for once and for all, is that I cannot speak Spanish, all right?
But you can sing in Spanish.
I know a few little words, but I've learned a few songs in Spanish, but I do need a few crib sheets on the floor to help me. Jesus Only You, which is a brand new song. You know, there's a piece in the middle of that song from Colombia where I do sing in Spanish, and you can hear the crowd sing along. It's beautiful, actually. Mm.
I understand that the kind of genesis of this record actually came out of a place going back some time to you feeling a little bit stale, and you prayed a prayer to God asking him to take you on a kind of adventure and for a bit more risk in your life. And out of that kind of came another band called Army of Bones. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the great thing about the world that I'm in, of course, it's mostly, you know, faith based songs that I write, you know, songs for the church, songs for people to sing on a Sunday morning, and there's nothing wrong in that. But of course, your whole world evolves around that system, that institution, that vision. For me, and those that have known my work for many years, there's always been that heart to push out, to not see that there are any walls between us and the world, to open up the walls, you know, the open up the doors and let the music play. So this was bugging me again, you know, after lots of years. And I just thought, yeah, what I really miss is doing some of those gigs or concerts outside the church in normal little clubs or theatres or whatever it is. And so at the age of 46, I started a new band called Army of Bones. Great thing about it was very organic. It's the same team that were coming out with me on all the worship stuff. So it wasn't kind of like different people or we were trying to be something we weren't. It was very natural. I wrote a whole album's worth of songs that were different from the normal. It was really all about my marriage, to be honest, just celebrating that. We'll be married 25 years next year. So it was a record of sort of saying, wow, this is quite amazing, we've come so far. And if you really listen to that record, you can hear me talking about some of the sort of bumps in the road and some of the dilemmas and some of the tensions of that over the years, as any marriage would have. I've been on the road a lot. We've had 6 kids. Our life is fairly chaotic. And so we are very grateful that we're still here in one piece. And that record is about our lives, really.
And that record had real kind of bite to it. You know, the guitars were up front. It was a real rock record.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating, of course, is we were just talking before we came on air about how this Love Song for a City album, it's the same band as Army of Bones again.
Yeah.
And again, you've kind of taken that rock feel back into the worship arena.
Yeah, I think what the Army of Bones stuff did, because we did several tours around the UK, and, you know, when you're starting out, you're starting from nowhere again. So it's back of a van, loading in gear, 20 people would show up, sometimes pretty disheartening, if I'm honest.
I can just say I was one of those 20 people. There were more than that at the London gig. It was a great night. And it was really fun, wasn't it? Because, you know, I mean, I was there. Obviously, I'm a Christian. I knew you guys were all Christians. But it wasn't almost for Christians, was it? It was, let's get out there outside the four walls of the church and have some fun, you know?
Yeah, and I think if you go back to the Delirious vision, it was always meant for people to be able to bring people.
Yeah.
And, like, we're in this together. You could bring anyone from work or school or college or wherever, and hopefully you'd feel okay in that atmosphere. Is it a worship time? Is it a gig? Couldn't really figure it out. And that really was what Delirious was. And in a sense, you know, I've just tried to do the same thing, but it really opened me up in a way that I wasn't expecting. That as we were in these little clubs, there's one song actually on the Bones record called Love Song for a City. Especially that song, as I was singing that, I'd feel quite emotional because here I was almost singing over people with the same anointing and gifting, you know, as when you lead worship. You know, you're wanting the presence of God to come. And, you know, some nights people would start crying and, you know, maybe they wouldn't realise why they're starting crying. And so I loved that challenge, and I loved being in front of those small crowds. It brought me alive again. And so I think I recaptured some of that vision for what it means to have a heart for a city, what it means to love a city, and then for someone like me to then go and sing over the city. And then it led beautifully into this new project with all these new worship songs. Yeah.
So what of Army of Bones, because like you said, it was hard work starting from scratch, brand new band, going around the UK touring these sort of small venues. And I guess, was that put on pause to make this record of more worship focused?
Yeah, it was put on pause. It's definitely not gone and it's still alive. But yeah, we concentrated on this, and also my guitar player had another baby.
Ah,
so okay. He's off the road for a little bit, Johnny, the amazing Johnny Bird. And so we'll see what the future holds. But, you know, it only takes one song to kind of get away or to be an advert or whatever it is that somehow it comes alive again.
Watch this space then.
Yeah, hopefully.
you're at an age now where your kids are growing up and you get to take some of them not only on tour with you, but they actually end up singing with you. I understand Ellie's actually on the record with you.
Yeah, Ellie started coming on the road with me probably when she was 17. Once she'd finished college, she suddenly had the time to do something. And so she came on the road and started growing in that, and she's got a great voice and, you know, great heart as well. So that's been a really nice season. So, yeah, she's on this record. She sings a couple of solos. And obviously she's the eldest of six. She's now married, and she's now called Ellie Linebear. And she's now making a record for Provident Records in Nashville. So it's amazing to see how God's blessed her life and blessing it. And
did you ever kind of hope or expect that some of your kids would go down the music road like yourself?
Well, I don't think we sat down and said this is like the plan. I think we've hopefully been parents that have let them get on with it. You know, you steer them a little bit. And you just find, though, that music's in their blood somehow. You know, they've been surrounded by so much music. They've been on the road with us as kids several times over the years. And so it's kind of in them, but no pressure. Whatever they want to do, you know, they can do whatever they like.
Sure. Well, we've already started talking about your kids, but here on The Profile, we like to go back right to the beginning of a person's life and hear some of their testimony. So for you growing up, did you grow up in a Christian atmosphere?
Yeah, I did. My mum and dad are great people. They are Brethren Church people. So that was what I was brought up with. You know, very small congregation of like 100 people in a small chapel in the middle of a housing estate. And and my dad was one of the, they called them elders, you know, one of the leaders. But none of the guys were full-time, you know, they all have professional jobs, and then in their part-time they'd run the church and run the youth work. My dad was very dedicated to that, and my mum. But so I wouldn't look back and say it was the liveliest of church upbringings.
do they sing Delirious songs, or not so much?
I don't know, actually. I think they banned them from their house. But, so yeah, they're great people, and you know, there weren't really things like Hillsong growing up, or
no.
Audacious Church, or you know, St. Peter's where I am in Brighton. So the church has come a long way in the last 20, 30 years.
Mm. I'd love to talk a bit more about that, actually, because Les Moyer sat in that chair last year, who I know you know well, and he authored this book called The Missing Jewel,
yeah.
Which I think you wrote the foreword for, actually. And The Missing Jewel is this phrase taken from A.W. Tozer, who said that worship was the missing jewel in the evangelical church. And Les really makes the argument that since Tozer wrote those words, there's been an explosion in what we kind of now call modern Christian music. And you look around, and there's whether it's Delirious, whether it's your songs, whether it's the Hill songs, This has all exploded in relatively recent and modern times. And I guess you've been a part of that. Mm. Was there a moment in your life where you kind of had that realization that, wow, this is a new movement, really, that's being birthed partly through what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm very privileged and honored to be part of that in a small way. I mean, really, you go back to Graham. Really,
Graham Kendrick,
in my opinion, would be he's the granddad of the whole movement. Shine, Jesus, shine, make way. Just brilliant songs, you know, very well crafted songs. And you see Graham now, and he's the same now than he was 40 years ago. He's not changed. Very humble guy. And so I think that we rode off the back of this sense that you could take worship music into a bigger arena, because you know, he was doing Spring Harvest, he was doing Make Way marches, and songs like Shine Jesus Shine, they had a size to them. They were meant for 6,000 people in a big top singing them, and I was 13 years old when I walked into one of those big tops. Graham was leading, and I felt that electricity run through my body. growing up in a Brethren church, not knowing much about the Holy Spirit, not having a framework for it, but just knowing, whoa, you know, whatever that is up there, I would love to do that. So I think he's the guy. And then, of course, Matt and Tim Hughes, several guys like that come along and then just keep taking it to the new generation. And Soul Survivor has played a big part in that. And yeah, it's amazing. And and of course, Hillsong, as you said, and Elevation Church and Mosaic Church, and it goes on and on and on, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes now when I listen to that Hillsong Young and Free record, I think, wow, what an amazing privilege to see this in my lifetime, how far this has come. Where it no longer kids would be embarrassed to play the Christian records. Yeah. Certainly I was as a kid. There weren't really any. I'd never sort of get my friends over from school and say, hey, listen to, you know. But now I think it's very close. And I think that's amazing that God's done that.
You were 13 when you first saw Graham Kendrick leading worship. When was the first time you led worship? Can you remember?
Yeah, probably 12 or 13. I wouldn't have called it leading worship, though.
Because, like you say, the language for that almost didn't quite exist.
No, it was a little youth group in our church, Chilton Church in Surrey, and a youth group of maybe 8 kids. And my dad said, look, I think we should sing. So you got to learn a guitar this weekend and do a song Sunday. And so that's what happened. I think I just did one song and it was probably awful. But more so, I would say it grew when I left home. And I moved to Eastbourne and joined a church there. And people were like raising their hands and like really joyful, really getting into it. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. There's like so much joy here. And it was there that a guy, his name was Peter Kegg. And out of the blue, he said, well, why don't you lead worship at the youth group? And I was like, well, what is that kind of, what do you mean? What is that? He says, oh, just get up with the guitar. You'll figure it out. But even then, I remember, even though it was very unpolished, way out of tune, very unprofessional, I remember that God would be there, you know, and I'd feel the presence of God in a room. And so I knew that this was a track that I wanted to go down, and and the rest is the story.
Yeah,
I guess
the rest is history. What was the next big milestone? Was it starting Cutting Edge Band? Or
the next big milestone for me was when I was 19, and I was working for a recording studio at the time in Eastbourne called ICC Studios. Part of my job was to record the live worship records at different events around the country. So I'd go off in my van, go to this event, plug in, and it was the very first New Wine event in 1989, and some people from Canada were leading worship, a guy called Andy Park, and I'd never felt anything like it. It was just so profound. The presence of God was so heavy, and I just knew in my own heart that these people had something I didn't quite have. And I realized my faith was quite cerebral in a way. Anyway, cut a long story short, I had a profound encounter with God and got filled with the Holy Spirit and went home the next day completely different, woke up and wrote a song called Lord, You Have My Heart. And I didn't know whether it was a worship song. I didn't know what it was, but it was just a little prayer. And what's beautiful about that song is that 30 years on, there's going to be a 30th anniversary version of that song, which my daughter Ellie's going to sing. So that'll be sweet. But yeah, I think that was a big landmark at 19.
I'm imagining an incredibly emotional moment in the recording studio when your daughter sings your song that you wrote 30 years ago.
Yeah, she's kind of got a really cool version of it. So I'm excited for people to hear that next year.
Wow. So coming back to your story then, tell me about the beginnings of the Cutting Edge Band.
Yeah, it was 1992, and I was part of a church called Aaron Community Church. And my future wife was there at the time, and some great guys running the youth team. And the idea was, great, let's start up a monthly worship night. We called it Cutting Edge. And basically, it was like 70 kids in a drama school theatre. And we just worshipped like crazy, turn the lights down so no one would be embarrassed. And it was just the beginning of something amazing, like a real move of God across young people in the south of England. And every month more people would come. And we did that for 5.5 years. And it kind of culminated in a big open air event on Littlehampton seafront where out of nowhere 10,000 people showed up. And it was great. You know, we were baptizing people on the seafront. Just that outdoors worship, that public worship thing, I love it when you've got people wandering around, people that you know live down your road. They're wandering around, they're hearing this music and they're captivated by it. And they might not like it, but they're captivated. It's like, wow, this is really fascinating.
Yeah,
this is what goes on in church. So, yeah, that was a key time for us. And effectively, the music team that came out of that monthly event turned into the band Delirious.
Yeah. And you faced that moment where you kind of had to take a big step of faith in saying, we're going to do this full time and be a band.
Oh, it was massive, yeah. And I can see
why. At a time when like Christian bands didn't really.
How many
bands at that time would have been Christian bands and doing it for a living?
I can't really think of many. There was one band in America called Violet Burning at the time that I can remember. I mean, you had your Newsboys, DC Talk and stuff like that. But it wasn't Five Families.
No.
You know? I think that's what people don't know completely about Delirious. It was five married couples and 17 children. Plus our manager had, you know, he was married and had loads of kids as well. So you're talking about doing something that supports all those people. So it was a complete miracle. And we decided to set up the business together and to really go into it together rather than kind of the singer and his band. It was like, no, come on, we're going to do this together. We're going to throw our lives into it. And I think God blessed that. And we were always able to provide. It was an amazing miracle, really.
Mm. So Delirious begins, and as you say, the kind of rest is history. And obviously, we don't have time to go through all the ins and outs. But just now, looking back on that time, you know, because we're actually now many years since Delirious disbanded, are there a few memories that you still sort of find yourself thinking about from those days? Are there recurring memories that come up of particular poignant times in the Delirious journey?
Yeah, there are several great memories. There was one of our first gigs in America was in a little nightclub called the Roxy, downtown LA. It was rammed with, I don't know, 600 people. The air conditioning had broken. So you can imagine Los Angeles in really hot. It was the sweatiest thing I'd ever done. And, but again, it was that outside feeling of we've got this music that God's given us, but we're outside the walls of the church. And that really was the vision. It was like we're on the streets doing this.
Mm.
That was amazing memory. Places like India, Cambodia, Africa. I remember an amazing time in India. We were going to play a big concert that night. I think it was Mumbai, And we went out during the day to visit one of the projects that the local organisation was supporting financially, one of the charities. And this was in the red light district in Mumbai. So it's quite, it was a little bit of a journey through all the streets. And we came across this ramshackle sort of hut with probably about 30 women in and about 70 children. And this project was looking after all these kids. Anyway, all these women are involved in the sex trade. So, you know, pretty sad, demoralizing, but beautiful children, no dads about. And so this, you know, trying to look after these mums, give them support. And, you know, some of the stories were pretty horrendous.
Yeah.
There was one girl there that caught my eye, and we eventually tried to sort of bring her back to England and maybe, you know, adopt her, but it didn't work out. But what I'm trying to say is that that night we brought them on a coach from that where they lived to the venue. I mean, they've not been to the end of their street, these kids, yeah. Let alone, you know, into the city. I think there were a couple of 100,000 people in the field. And I just remember at the end of the night getting all the children up and their mums, and just them joining in with us, you know, dancing. And you could see their eyes light up. Their children were loving it. You've got these women that have got, you know, in the eyes of a lot of people in that front row, living shameful lives, but they're on stage with us dancing and singing. And I got a bit of a glimpse of heaven that night, and I will never, ever forget that.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. It's The Profile this afternoon, where we sit down with a different person every week to find out more about their life, faith and ministry. You've just heard the first part of my interview with Martin Smith, the songwriter, worship leader and former Delirious frontman. There's lots more to come from him right after this.
Premier Christianity Magazine, in this month's issue.
You just tell the love of Jesus, how he died to save us all.
Bishop Michael Curry preached up a storm at the royal wedding, with his message being described as fiery, passionate and raw God. But what was it like to be Bishop Curry on that day? How has he handled the flame that's followed? And what would Jesus make of our royal family? In the latest edition of Premier Christianity Magazine, we ask him. Plus, discover how Christians all over the world celebrate the festive season in our brand new December issue.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
Good news! We've slashed the cost of subscribing to the UK's leading Christian magazine. Now you can read news from a Christian perspective and interviews with fascinating leaders for half the normal price. That's 12 issues of Premier Christianity magazine for less than £20. Plus, take out a subscription and we'll enter you into a prize draw to win £200 worth of new Christian books. There's never been a better time to subscribe. Go to premierchristianity.com/subscribe.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome back to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. My guest today is Martin Smith, the former Delirious frontman, worship leader and so much more. Let's find out more about Martin's faith journey and some of the things that he's passionate about. Here's part two of my interview with Martin Smith. I wanted to talk about one of the final projects Delirious put out, Kingdom of Comfort, because that album, a huge part of that was recognising injustice. The opening lines even of that record, you know, save me from the kingdom of comfort where I'm king, from my unhealthy lust of material things. Later on, Our God Reigns, my Chinese takeaway could pay for someone's drugs, yeah. You know, highlighting the kind of injustice around the world. Tell me more about how that kind of revelation came about for you, and really for you as a band, I think, because that was quite a powerful, that album was making a very powerful point.
Yeah, it was a really big time for us, because we had started traveling to, I would say, some of the more two-thirds world nations, some poorer countries, and with a preacher from America called Joyce Meyer, who's an amazing lady. And so One minute we'd be on stage, another minute we'd be on a rubbish tip in Cambodia with 100 kids just trying to fetch rubbish out of the dump to make a living. You know, just disgusting, heartbreaking stuff. And I think it really affected us very deeply. And I think a culmination of those trips, I remember getting back in the studio and Stoogie turning his amp on, and just the sound of his guitar through that amp, it was just India. It was just like, it was like a heart cry of, yeah, we've got to do something about this, you know. So, you know, that's the amazing thing about music. It does, what gets into your blood comes out in your music. You can hear it on that record that we were asking big questions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some people will kind of critique worship leading or big events, and they'll say things like, well, it's, you know, it's wonderful to see Christians raising their hands in worship and being so passionate, but what happens when the music stops? Are we actually living out our faith in such a passionate way day to day? It's one thing to sing a song, right? Another thing to save someone from a rubbish tip in the third world.
Yeah, of course. And I guess that's the great challenge of the Christian faith, is that we do believe that God can do anything, but also he's expecting us to do it as well. So it's a mixture, isn't it, of so many stories through the scriptures of God commissioning people to do things. You know, here's an assignment. I want you to rebuild the walls of Jericho, or I want you to walk through the Dead Sea, or I want you to, you know, there's so many stories. But then we have to get up off our butt and actually do it. And that's the bit that's hard, because that is uncomfortable. And so, you know, that's the thing that we all have to work out for ourselves, is there has to be some sense of danger in our life, you know, to keep us alive. And that was partly one of the reasons for doing the Army of Bones project. It felt a bit dangerous, and, you know, this could sink everything, but, you know, you've got to keep getting out there in front of people that would never come to church.
It's interesting, as people kind of look back, there's a Christian author called Mark Sayers who spends a lot of his time kind of critiquing culture and Christianity. And he was remarking that kind of in the church from 1989 to 2008, he called it an era of relevancy, where we were very against the kind of Christian ghetto. And like you said, we want to get out there and impact culture. And Mark talks about a band like Switchfoot in the US who kind of reached a level of cool and crossed over a little bit. And you guys did here as well. You crossed over into the mainstream. It was Deeper that went to number 20 in the charts. So do you still kind of believe in that way of thinking about mission, of being relevant to the culture? Because some have suggested that's, you know, how much impact does that have? Let's say if someone's listening to the top 20 and they hear Deeper, they don't know that you're Christians, the song isn't overtly about Christianity, you know, what does it actually achieve? Some people are a bit negative about this idea of cultural relevance.
That's a really good question, and I think that's the mystery of art, isn't it? You know, two people can go into an art gallery, see exactly the same painting, one can be moved to tears, and the tears might bring healing in a certain area, and one might walk past it as though it's completely meaningless. So the cool factor or the relevancy factor is so subjective. You know, what's cool to me might not be cool to you. What's relevant to one part of culture is completely irrelevant to the other. And so as when you get onto music, it's the same. So I don't think you can be cool enough. I don't think you can ever be cool enough to kind of, in essence, be cool. You just have to be yourself and be authentic. And hopefully in that God might use you, you know. You're just hoping that the things you bring to the table, God might be able to say, great, I can use that.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've got bands like U2 over the years who have had a huge impact on culture. And the cynics would say, well, you know, but has it grown the church? Well, in a sense, that's the wrong question to ask. The question to ask is, has it brought comfort to people? And I would say absolutely. It brings comfort to the soul. Great art keeps your heart soft. And when your heart is soft, then that's when God can move in and speak. And he can touch your life. If your heart is made of stone, it's hard. You know, it's hard for God to deal with that. So, and I would include a lot of mainstream stuff, you know. There's some great music out there that keeps the heart soft. Mm. It might not necessarily come out of church people, but it's equally as important.
Yeah.
And, you know, we must give value to that.
Yes. I confess, I didn't have you down as a Stormzy fan, but I understand you've been enjoying some of his work, for example.
Yeah, I do love that record. It's brilliantly put together, Gang Signs and Prayer. And I went to the show at Brixton.
Yeah.
And I was captivated by it. He's a leader, and he's definitely understood that he's got a higher calling. It's not just about his music, but I think he understands that he's on the planet to do something very significant. And, you know, we'll see what happens, you know.
Yeah. Do you, are you sort of thinking more about raising other musicians up, you know, whether they're worship leaders or whether they're Christians who want to go into mainstream? Is that part of day-to-day life for you now in trying to encourage others to come through and learn from you and take it further?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure they can learn anything, but I am intentional about finding people with that heart and just trying to be a friend, you know, trying to be an older brother or whatever. And if I can help in any way, that's great. But the key to it is not trying to find people that look like you or sound like you. I think that would be very easy to sort of, oh yeah, what I need to do is find the next sort of worship leader, acoustic guitar player, white guy. You know, oh yeah, that's who I need to mentor. But it's really about finding people who carry the fire. You know, it's carry that fire for God, fire for their cities, fire for culture, and just trying to be people's friends.
You mentioned before when you first started leading worship, you said very humbly that you sure it didn't sound very good and it was you're a bit out of tune or whatever. Sometimes when I talk to people who are perhaps a little bit older than me and they talk about worship in the 1970s and 80s, I often hear people say it was amazing, like you just recalled, of how it didn't have to be the best music.
Yeah.
People weren't the best singers, they didn't know all the chords, and yet the Holy Spirit really turned up in a powerful way. And I just wonder sometimes, it is the danger of where we're at right now, that we have got so much amazing, professional, well done music. Is there a danger that some worship teams kind of seek after, well, we've just got to replicate that guitar part and we've got to focus so much on how it sounds and finding the best guitarist in church? Is there a danger we lose the kind of the heart behind it?
Yeah, of course. And it's an individual thing, isn't it? You know, it's not a blanket sort of, oh, I think this is happening right now in the church, because there are some people that pursue perfection at all costs. But of course, you can never achieve perfection, you know, it's elusive. So what does that really look like? Is it the perfect worship set that ends on time? Is it the lights come up at the right time and down? You know, to someone that could be perfect, but to someone else that could be, oh, I don't really like that, I prefer it to be a bit more lo-fi. So that's very subjective. And then, you know, you go back to that season, and I think the one word that sums it up is passion. Mm. You've got a new move of God in the United Kingdom. As you say, 1970, 1980, you've got the house church movement growing outside the established church. Pockets of people around the country just worshipping like crazy, seeing miracles, seeing people healed. I think passion will always rule over perfection. It's not wrong to aim for perfection, And it's not also right to just have passion without a little bit of framework and at least, you know, sort of turn the sound system on and have the mic sounding okay. That's fine.
Yeah.
But, I think that the thing that we sometimes are guilty of now is that church can be a bit consumerist. So when I look at my kids' generation, you can see a little bit of consumerism creeping into their Christianity. It's like, yeah, I love Jesus, I'm into God, but as long as I like this meeting, as long as I like what's going on, I can do this. But if it's sort of the wrong songs or the wrong vibe, or then I'm not really into that, then that there's alarm bells there.
Right, yeah.
And I think, you know, you should be able to just worship God wherever you are and train that muscle to just be grateful to God wherever.
Yeah. I was really interested to speak to Dan Blythe, who works at Hillsong, and he said something very similar I thought was very profound. And he said that it's a sign of spiritual maturity as we grow that you can worship God in a cathedral with an organ, or you can worship God at a rock concert. Mm. And there's a maturity in learning how to, like you say, worship God anywhere.
Yeah, and God is omnipresent, and you can find God in anything because there's always good in something, and God is good. And yeah, you find it, don't you? And you know, we're only talking about style, aren't we? You know, the nature of God and the wonder of God will never change. I mean, that's who he is. So you can't change those things. The only things that change are the way we do it. And 35 years ago, you wouldn't have found many drum kits in a church. And now pretty much across the world, every church has got a drum kit. And so it's just the way we do things that change, along with sort of the haircuts and skinny jeans or, you know, flares or whatever. That will always change. But as you say, the maturity is, well, this is who God is. He's Alpha and Omega. And so let's just get down to business.
Yeah. What do you do when you're feeling a bit dry spiritually, where you've lost sight of who God is, or when you're finding it hard to praise or to write worship? Are there things that you do that help you reconnect with God and find that passion again?
Yeah, personally for me, the dryness comes when I'm a bit overworked, a bit busy. I've taken on a few things that I shouldn't have done, which has sort of sapped my energy. And I'm trying to learn the art of, you know, just doing things that I feel are the right things. But of course, you can never get that one completely right. We do things with good intentions. And I notice personally for me, if I'm in a season where I'm really in the Word of God, you know, that's the antidote for dryness, is just being in the Word of God. It's alive, it's living, it always speaks, and that's the thing that brings you life. You know, it is alive. So, you know, that's a good discipline.
Yeah. You mentioned growing up in Brethren Church, and I know you're now in St. Peter's Church in Brighton. And I think I'm right in saying that you've, throughout your life, been in lots of different kinds of churches. And certainly when you've gone around the world and toured, you've toured in all sorts of different denominations. You know, would you describe yourself as an Anglican, or would you describe yourself as someone who enjoys and doesn't really feel allegiance with any one denomination?
Yeah, I mean, I'm being fully respectful here. I mean, I don't think I would refer to myself as an Anglican, but also I don't know many Anglicans that would also refer to themselves as Anglicans necessarily, because I think people's worldview is bigger than that now. We realize that God is blessing so many different movements, churches around the world. Each have their strengths and each have their weaknesses. You know, I think for us as a family, we feel we're part of an amazing local church in Brighton called St. Peter's. And it just happens that it's in a cathedral. But that very same church could also be in a school hall or a warehouse, and be equally as dynamic and strategic. And so, yeah, I think that God's doing amazing thing across the whole breadth of the church, and it's amazing to see.
How does it work when someone like yourself walks into St. Peter's and joins? And, you know, it's not like you're the average punter. I mean, you're someone who's written worship songs that are sung around the world. Do you sort of turn up and apply for the worship team? And, you know, you might get in, you might not.
Well, we've got an amazing team at St. Peter's, and it's led by a brilliant guy who I can really say has become a great friend. His name's Paul Nelson. A really exceptional guy. He's in charge of all of it. I think if I tried to run a local worship team, it would last about 2 weeks.
Why is that?
I think I'd probably forget to book a bass player and a drummer.
The admin side of things.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think I'd...
Is it true that musicians, generally speaking, are pretty terrible at organisation?
It's not completely true, but...
As a generalisation.
Generalisation, because... The creative bit of your brain, to do that well, it can't function at the same time in the administrational realm. You know, they say that when you're creating, you have to flick on a bit of your brain which is purely able to get lost in that. But you're not able at the same time to adjudicate that performance. So that's why you need other people to help you judge how your life is going, or is this a good song? So you need a whole team of people. You need lots of people in your life to sort of give you balance. But there are some very rare people that are administrational and creative, but usually the genius type people, that's all they can do.
The creative side is all they can do.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And the stronger that is, the less the other thing is.
So one of the things that St. Peter's is quite well known for, as well as being part of the kind of HTB network, it was planted out of Holy Trinity, Brompton, as one of a number of very successful church plants from that kind of part of the Church of England, is the other thing it's known for is Bright City, which I remember when that first record came out, I was incredibly excited by it. Seemingly came out of nowhere, just very fresh sounding worship music from the team at St. Peter's, and you've obviously had some involvement in that. So tell me a bit about the Bright City project.
Yeah, it's been a great experience actually, because simply at the heart of it was, you know, let's get all the songwriters in the church, and we're talking about, you know, the 17, 18, 19, 20 year olds, put them in a room. And we would usually do those retreats at our house in Brighton. And we'd eat lots of food and try and write loads of songs. And it was just amazing to see all these brilliant ideas coming out of nowhere. The brief that I remember giving people quite intentionally was, look, don't try and write this so it's going to be sung on a Sunday morning. Just please just let out of you what is inside of you, and don't try and sort of churchize it and think, oh, if I do this and do that, then it's going to be a church song or whatever. But really let out what's inside of you. And I think you can hear that on those two projects. It's a very young sort of a expression of like, this is amazing. God's alive and we have no boundaries.
How would you describe your calling?
I've never been asked that before. How would I describe my calling? Well, I love music, and I actually believe in the power of music. You know, if you go back to 1 Samuel and the story about the shepherd boy David, and King Saul calls him in with his harp, you know, they commission him to play before the king because, you know, he's got an evil spirit that he's tormented by. I think that's kind of me, really. You know, it's I don't have much in my hands, but I do believe that when you play music or you sing over people, that stuff can happen. And so that story is in the scriptures for a reason, and it's there to remind us that actually spiritual music, God music, whatever it is that's blessed by God, it's powerful.
Mm.
You know, that's why the worshippers were at the front line of the army, because there was power in that. And so whether I'm with Army of Bones in a little club with 20 people, or in a stadium full of people and they're singing Waiting Here for You or Majesty, I'm expecting God to do supernatural things. And so if I could sum it up, I don't know necessarily what my calling is, but I believe that God can move through music. And I've seen that over the years, and I believe it hugely.
You'll remember a time, I'm sure, in the 80s and 90s, where much of the UK church was really praying for revival.
Mm.
And more than that, really believing it was around the corner. Is that something that's still on your heart, you think is still coming, that you...
Yeah, I think that if you... You know, the problem with our brains is that we can only observe the season that we're in. We can only live in the moment in history that we're actually in. But, you know, we have now the hindsight of looking over, you know, a 2,000-year history of the Christian faith, and then you see seasons where there's a, the faith struggles, and then there's seasons of renaissance, and you see these highs and lows throughout history. And I think that this is an amazing season to be alive in, because feels to me like God's doing more behind the scenes, behind our back, than we realize.
In what way?
Well, you look at the two most powerful leaders in the Christian faith, the head of the Catholic Church, the Pope, the head of the Anglican Church, two spirit-filled guys that love Jesus. I think that's a new thing.
It says something, though, that... that's a new thing. I mean, yeah. You would hope that would always be the case.
I mean, those guys have been at war with each other in history, but there they are in the same room. And I've heard Justin Welby talk about the time when he first met Pope Francis, and they just laughed for half an hour at the whole ridiculousness that he's the Pope and he's the head of the Anglican Church, Archbishop of Canterbury, and how they're just ordinary guys called by God to serve the kingdom of God. So I think that's quite a key thing. And I think there are some things happening in government, which I hear about, which I think, again, things happening behind the scenes, which are very positive. You've got amazing music being made, not often in the guise of Christian music, but people that are connecting with a new generation in a totally different way, and I love that. I think there's a lot to be hopeful for.
I really enjoy speaking to optimists, but I have to play the devil's advocate here.
Yeah,
and say, you know, less than 2% of the country go to church. Every survey that comes out about faith in this country, almost every survey, seems to suggest decline, certainly decline in traditional denominations like the Church of England. Anecdotally, you talk to people about the size of their youth groups and children's work, and there's a lot of bad news around as well, isn't there?
Yeah, of course there is. And it's a very worrying time to be a parent, isn't it? And so we live in difficult times for sure. Just because church statistics don't look good, you know, without what you're assuming is that a generation and a culture can only be touched if they walk in a church building. But of course, God is much bigger than that. He's moving through art, through sport, through culture, through so many different things. And that's what I'm saying. That's why art is so important, because it keeps people soft. And what we're praying for is a bigger thing anyway.
Hmm.
We're not praying, are we, or living for, oh, maybe we can get it back up to 5% of church attendance. Oh, that would be great. Or maybe 6%. We're actually living and breathing and praying for a move of God upon the nation. And that's a different thing. Mm. That's a sovereign thing. That's outside of our control. That's something that God, when he chooses to visit a nation in power. And we've seen that in history. And you've got to hope for that, haven't you?
Yes. Some lyrics are coming to mind as you say this about, we can see God, you're moving, through the nations when young and old return to Jesus, fling wide your heavenly gates. You know, this is something you've clearly felt and been writing about for a long time now. So is it always easy to be so optimistic as you've just said? You know, there must be days, surely, where you think, am I really going to see some of those things I wrote about? Or is this sense of hope and faith always there?
Well, I'm like everybody, you know, I read the news every day and I absorb the tragicness of the world. I think mental health, especially young people, is going to grow. And that's going to become very dangerous for culture. And I get very sad about that. Image for kids is a huge thing. You know, not really ever feeling like they're ever going to match up. And suddenly at a young age, you know, a child's soul is kidnapped, you know, by this idea that you're never going to make it. You're never going to be on Love Island, you know. And it's an evil disease. So I get angry about that. Of course I do. But also, you know, you read about the amazing things that Jesus is. And we either believe that or we don't. You know, that he's the saviour of the world. He's come to bring hope and peace. And, you know, when he was here on the earth, he did extraordinary things. And you have to believe that he's alive and he's going to continue to do extraordinary things. Mm. So keep going, everyone.
So you've got a new project coming on the way, I understand, a new solo project coming out next year in 2019. How much more can you reveal at this stage about what it's going to look like?
Yeah, it's going to be a studio record, this one. And I'm very excited about it because it's going to be all brand new songs. And it's been a long time since I've done a proper studio record of any worth, really. The God's Great Dance Floor stuff really was more my demos from my home studio that kind of made it out. But I didn't have a proper producer on them. I didn't, you know, it was just where I was. I'd left Delirious, and you can hear that sort of, I'm in my own space doing that. But now I feel a bit more ready to sort of go a bit bigger on this one. And I'm going to work with a guy called Gabriel Wilson in Portland, Oregon. And he's a great producer. Just produced John Mark McMillan's record and various other things. So that's going to be an honour to work with him.
Mm. Is it going to sound more like kind of the worship stuff, or is it going to be more Army of Bones or a mixture?
I'm hoping it will sound like nothing.
Sound like
I've
nothing
ever done.
You've ever done before.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping for. Yeah. That it will be.
You get what I mean, though, because I mean, maybe we go back to your earlier comment about saying, well, don't actually write songs as if you think they're going to be sung on a Sunday morning in a church. Mm. But you know, nowadays, maybe you're breaking the mold. But nowadays, generally speaking, an album will come out, and either people will think, oh yeah, this is a load of songs I can sing on a Sunday, or oh, this is Martin trying to do something he did like with Mesomorphis or Audio Lesson Over, where it wasn't specifically for the Christian world necessarily.
And I think you have to be true to your calling, don't you? And I've always got one eye and one ear on people that I know will probably not walk in through the doors of my church, but I want to give them some music that they're going to like. Now, you know, you take a song like 10,000 Reasons, it's possibly the greatest church song of our time, you know, it's certainly in the last 10, 15 years, it's a hymn. And so that's true to Matt's calling. And, you know, we're great friends, but we have different lanes. And that's okay, isn't it? And there is no doubt that the church needs those songs. Mm. You do. We all need those. Church couldn't exist without those songs. But also there are some songs that sit in the middle, which maybe in 20 years' time, church might be singing them. So you have to just stick to what you believe you're called to do.
I like that idea. It's quite a pioneering way of thinking about your own music, isn't it? Saying, well, I'm going to be an artist. And we've mentioned that word art quite a lot in this interview. And just to bring us back to it again, because I've heard people remark in the past that the church hasn't always been great at honouring artists. Mm. I can think of Delirious songs and records where, you know, you had criticism from the church who didn't necessarily get the heart behind it. They didn't understand, well, you know, you hadn't written that song for a Sunday morning. You'd written that song because of what you already said about taking God outside the four corners of the church and to make art for others who don't know Christ yet.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? You're always living in the tension. I remember there was one song. Oh, you might know what record it's on. I can't remember now. It was called It's Okay. Basically, we were in America and we were doing a show there. And after, this girl came up to us with a friend. Very, very sad. You know, looked in a right state. And just basically told us that the week before, this girl tried to take her own life, tried to commit suicide. But she'd been rescued by this friend. And she was at our concert to sort of live to tell the story that, well, I'm still here. And of course, she was very moved by the night and had a sense that God was with her. So I remember just looking at this girl thinking, you know, you look like death warmed up, literally, you know, and you're going to need a lot of help and a lot of care. So I remember putting in the line, you know, she's as pretty as hell and her eyes have no home. And it was, for me, just a really poetic way of describing. She was very pretty, very beautiful, but there was a tension there, you know. She'd touched the dark side, you know, and I remember, you know, getting the call that a whole chain of bookstores in America had banned the record just because of that one line. But then that song going on to be people's favourites in a lot of ways, and you know, radio played it here in the UK, and of course, no one outside the church has an issue, and in fact, they're moved by it, touched by it. It's like, oh, wow, this is kind of a real thing rather than sugar-coated. So, you know, we've had our knocks over the years and not, of course, not done everything right and been sometimes a bit, you know, feel like we know it all. But, yeah, that would be an example of you just can't please everybody.
Welcome to my world as a magazine editor. I know exactly what you mean. So I feel like, and this might just be me being hopeful, but I feel like some sort of Delirious reunion, one-off gig, one-off tour is only a matter of when rather than if. Am I being too hopeful?
Well, look, we're all good friends. And, you know, I mean, two of the guys are my brother-in-laws. So we still do birthdays and Christmas and hang out. I'm good friends with Stu and John. So I don't know. It's interesting when you've left something for so long. You know, it'll be 10 years next year.
Which is a great excuse to a reunion tour. Just saying, Martin.
And everybody's moved into a new season, a new calling. And I don't know. I think if the right thing came up and it felt like a lot of fun, you never know.
I bet there's never been an interview post-Delirious where you haven't been asked that question.
It's been asked a few times, but more and more recently.
I apologise. Well, I don't apologise, but I keep asking it because I know that's exactly what people want. And hey, maybe, just maybe at some point in the future. But Martin, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting. Thank you so much for coming in.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. That was my interview with the worship leader and former Delirious frontman, Martin Smith. I really hope you enjoyed that interview. I certainly had a great time meeting Martin and hearing so much of his story. If you want to hear more great interviews like this one, why not check out the archive on the Profile podcast? We've got over 100 interviews now from Christian leaders around the world involved in all sorts of different things. You're sure to find more episodes of interest. Just have a look. And while you're doing that, if you wouldn't mind giving us a rating and a review, that would really help more people to discover the show. Please do also share it around on social media. It all really helps us get this show out to more and more people. That's all we've got time for this week. We'll see you next time.